You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Thank you.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, I am Siegfried, and welcome comrades and friends to our second episode about writing radical fiction. I felt I needed a bit more of a dramatic intro there to start things out, so I picked the track Victorious Titus from the Titus Andronicus official soundtrack from the Anthony Hopkins movie that he did back in 1999, based on the Shakespeare play Titus Andronicus. And I felt that that was a little more in keeping with the theme where, you know, I'm the one who's writing fantasy, you know, dark fantasy, so to speak. And I talked about that last week. Last week, I talked about my own experience about being both a communist and a fiction writer in the fantasy genre. And a bit about how challenging that is, given how conservative a genre fantasy is and has been historically. And in many ways continues to be with regard to contemporary examples like Game of Thrones. I talked a bit about that. I talked about how fantasy traditionally concerns itself with the restoration of an idealized past, or the perpetuation of the status quo, you know, the return of the king, the revival of an idealized feudal order where everything is in its right place. You know, a convention that even more radical fantasy writers like Ursula Le Guin and Michael Moorcock had difficulty getting beyond. And I also talked about the inspiration that I got from the communist playwright Bertolt Brecht and how audiences can be made more receptive to radical ideas when they are expressed in a way that breaks people out of their immersion in everyday realities and forces them to think critically about what they are reading or viewing. But most importantly, I talked about the need to place working class and oppressed people, rather than aristocrats and elites, you know, and kings and all this sort of thing, you know, at the center of fantasy and science fiction stories. You know, and I want to talk a little more tonight about why that's important and why I come at writing in this way. First, I want to stress the importance of history and of historical memory in the present moment, with what's going on in the world right now. On Friday, I attended the Guelph Climate Strike event. I marched with students from the University of Guelph down to City Hall in downtown Guelph and witnessed this extraordinary coming together around the issue of climate change. Over 500 people showed up. There were banners, megaphones, and speeches. People seemed to recognize that capitalism was the problem and the real force behind climate change and the global environmental crisis that we're in now, right? They recognize that capitalism is the problem. But I couldn't help but notice the literally night and day distinctions between the speeches made about climate change by indigenous people on one hand and white settlers on the other. Because those speakers who were white talked overwhelmingly about the future and the need to save future generations from the effects of climate change. They didn't talk about the past. They didn't talk about history. You know, their ancestors or historical experience. And indigenous people did. The indigenous people who spoke, including a good friend of mine, drew a clear line between the past and the present and the future. They connected the struggles of their ancestors against residential schools and colonial genocide with the present struggles against pipelines and with the well-being of future generations, you know, in the face of climate change. And because they understood and were connected with their past, their understanding of the future was a whole lot clearer than that of the white speakers, many of whom were engaging in activism for the very first time and who were inspired to become activists not by the example of indigenous land defenders, who have been fighting to protect the very survival of their people for a very long time, but by this Swedish girl, Greta Thunberg, who's been all over the news lately. So, like, their hearts are definitely in the right place, and I'm glad they're becoming activists now, but they still have a lot to learn. And it seems like they're not really situated so much in the real context that they really need to be situated in, to really understand what's going on and really to fight back effectively. I mean, class struggles and struggles against injustice and oppression never spring from nowhere. You know, they always have a history in previous struggles that shape the conditions in which new struggles emerge. And people identify with past struggles based on their own lived experience, material conditions, and, you know, the material conditions of their lives and their connection with previous generations. You know, indigenous peoples have that connection. Black people have that connection. Latino people have that connection. So do people in the formerly colonized countries of Africa and Asia. And even European peoples like the Irish have that connection, which runs deep within their culture. But white North Americans typically do not. White North Americans typically do not have a very good understanding of the past and of history. White North Americans who have, you know, paid the price of the ticket, as James Baldwin, African-American writer James Baldwin said, and who gave up their roots in what is now called Europe in order to become white, to be granted a privileged position in a colonial society, and to bind up their fate with the settler colonial project based on genocide and slavery in North America. Effectively, they went from being a people, from being people rooted in a time and place, to being rootless tools and weapons of empire. That's the price of the ticket. White people are, you know, whiteness is an artificial, manufactured creation of empire rather than, you know, an organic culture or society. And it shows. I would recommend people read Theodore W. Allen's brilliant book, The Invention of the White Race, if they want to understand more about how and why this took place, about how impoverished emigres from numerous European countries were transformed into foot soldiers in a genocidal war, basically to make the North American continent safe for capitalism from sea to shining sea. And of course, to do that, they went in there and basically, you know, destroyed the independent nations of indigenous people. And of course, then that history is then whitewashed. I mean, that's not to say that there hasn't been a history and tradition of class struggle in North America among working people of European descent. Of course there has. You know, of course there was the struggle for unionization and, like, the struggles against, you know, and of course anti-war movements and all this sort of stuff and, like, struggles for the 8-hour day and, you know, very, very intense levels of class struggle. You know, like with the Haymarket Massacre and all that, and the Winnipeg General Strike. But it's much easier to convince a rootless white person who has been taught to blame non-white people for all their problems to forget about that history of class struggle. You know, it's easier to convince them to forget about that, a white person to forget about that history of class struggle, than it is to convince, say, an Irish person living on their own ancestral land in a country that's still partially colonized by Britain to forget about class struggle. Because fundamentally, white people are not taught to really understand history. Real history. And this is especially true if said white person leads a cushy life in a suburb built on stolen native land on the outskirts of Guelph, Ontario, having reaped the benefits of the post-war economic boom that followed World War II and allowed them to believe that capitalism was good and humane, and who haven't known real hardship or struggle since their grandparents' generation in the 30s and the 40s. And they're probably not all that familiar with that history either. I grew up in a suburb like that, on the western edge of Guelph. I was far removed from the ills of the world as a kid. And apart from some difficulties fitting in at school, which, looking back, were actually pretty minor, I had a pretty amazing childhood. I mean, I had to learn about the true state of the world from other people. You know, people like Mrs. Baker, my 8th grade homeroom teacher, who got in a lot of trouble. She got in a lot of trouble when she taught my class about sweatshop labor and third world poverty. You know, people like Mr. Walker, an Aboriginal Mohawk man and a Marxist, who unapologetically taught the real colonial history of Canada and of European imperialism in my high school history and civics classes. Or Professor Eidlin, my thesis advisor in university, who taught me to question established narratives and to always ask why. You know, those people and many more besides taught, brought me to the point. They brought me to the point where I could become a communist in an anti-communist society, where I could become an ally of indigenous peoples in the context of a settler colonial society, and where I could come to grips with the cruel realities of capitalism and imperialism, which I didn't have experience with directly growing up. So when I write, because of my privileged situation, I didn't experience those realities growing up. So when I write fantasy novels, when I write this literature, it's coming from that lived experience and from those people who influenced me. As I found out about the world and how the world really works. And the same holds true for any writer. They write based on their experience and based on the people who influence them and all that. No writer comes from nowhere. But I think I can safely say that my experience differs from that of many fantasy writers who are content to churn out stories that glorify kings and empires, and follow these essentially conservative themes that I talked about in last week's show. Meanwhile, I'm more interested in the history and experience of those who fight against kings and empires, whether in a fictional world or in the real world. I want to tell their stories and have that mean something, have that get to people. For me, it's a part of a broader struggle for justice worldwide, not a hobby. It's my contribution. It's something that I choose to do. From the same reason that I choose to teach my Chinese students when I teach ESL in China about the real history of settler colonialism genocide in Canada. I feel that's my responsibility. I've talked about that on the show. Given what I've learned and what I've experienced, writing for me cannot be simply a diversion or an escape, unlike some of the fantasy writers I recently encountered when I went to the Eden Mills Writers Festival for the first time earlier this month. And writing can't just be about warning people and painting gruesome pictures of dystopian futures and lamenting how bad everything is either. Writing is a part of the fight for liberation. It's part of the fight for justice and emancipation. It's about confronting and exposing the destructive forces of imperialism, colonialism, and capitalism. Even if that writing happens in fictional format, you can still deal with those themes. These very real-world issues, you can still deal with that. You can still confront that. It's about expressing solidarity with those who fight against those forces. Imperialism, colonialism, capitalism all around the world. And it's about showing that those forces can be defeated and that something better, regardless of its imperfections, can be built. And certainly that's not where you're getting from these, you have sci-fi, you have cyberpunk really coming into vogue right now. And it shows all the bad stuff. It shows all the bad and like crazy stuff and like how bad the future is going to be and unjust and all this sort of stuff. But it doesn't give you any prospect of any reason to hope. It doesn't give you any, show people fighting back in a meaningful way or trying to build something better. It just shows you, this bad, grim situation and just leaves you with that, which is, I would say a horrible thing to do. That's actually a dereliction of duty, I believe, as a writer. Because what we really need right now is to really have writers who can, at least in their writing, but even if that's in a fictional setting, show that there is a way forward. Just as people in the past and people in the present are struggling to build something better, build something new, build something radically different, a new society. That also has to be in fiction. That also has to be in all the genres of literature. So people can understand they can fight back, they can win victories. And I believe, regardless of how overwhelming the odds seem to be, and how overwhelming, how, like, you know, how powerful, you know, oppressive and exploited forces seem to be. You know, victory still can be won. New societies can be built. You know, oppression can be defeated and cast down. And I believe it is my responsibility, given my situation at this crisis point in human history, you know, where the evils of capitalism are becoming increasingly blatant and in people's faces, and as the climate crisis closes in, you know, to express the class struggle through whatever medium I can. You know, and that includes the fantasy genre, which is a genre I've always been into and been interested in. I mean, like I said, it's hard for people who come from a background like mine, a privileged background like mine, to understand the way the world really works. It can be a very, very long and circuitous route to actually get to that understanding. And even then, I mean, you know, you have like blind spots and things you need to work on. You know, but to really understand like how horrific the current situation in the world is, and to understand why so many people risk their lives every day fighting for a livable future, along with justice for, you know, not only their kids and future generations, but also for their ancestors and those who came before them, carrying on a legacy and history of struggle as they fight against capitalism, colonialism, imperialism. And, you know, maybe setting, you know, me as a writer, maybe by setting these kinds of struggles, struggles for liberation, in a fictional setting, by setting my stories just far enough beyond the real world to make readers let down their guard and let down their assumptions for me, but still have those stories be close enough to drive the message home, however uncomfortable it might be, you know, I can make it easier for them to open their eyes. It's my hope anyway. I'm going to take a little bit of a break right here, music break. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. And this is a suitable tune, I think. Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was The Handsome Furs with Serve the People. Thought it was a fitting song to play, given what I'm talking about here. And so, of course, I'm talking about my own writing here. Being a communist and a fiction writer and all that, you know, writing fantasy. So I'm working on a novel right now that I intend to make into a trilogy. And this trilogy will explore the revolutionary birth of a new nation, a republic, out of the ashes of an ancient and oppressive empire. And the setting of this trilogy is a region of the fictional world I've created known as the Thousand Cities. And Thousand Cities is like medieval Italy or medieval Germany. It's divided into many petty warring states, principalities, duchies, areas ruled by the church, and so on. And this land was once the heart of the Empire of the Five Seals, a theocratic empire ruled by a powerful church and an emperor claiming divine right. You know, before its collapse amid civil war, almost 2 centuries before the events of the trilogy take place. And since then, the land has been divided between rival lords, while the church is trying to reassert itself through a bloody inquisition, and foreign empires compete for influence and resources. And the protagonists of the trilogy will thus have to face the brutalities of feudalism and capitalism alike in order to create a new society that will give the people of this land a future. And these heroes will not be perfect. They will not be lost messiahs or chosen ones. They will have all the hang-ups that come from growing up in a highly oppressive and exploitative society. You know, and thus some revolutionaries will have trouble treating women as equals, for example, or respecting those who come from a lower class background, or who come from a marginalized or oppressed nationality or a persecuted religious group. And it's only through hard experience in the face of terrible enemies that they will learn to walk a new path. Many of them will not survive the journey. You know, so yes, main characters will die in my books, you know, no question. I mean, if you look at the actual history of revolutionary struggle, and I believe, once again, that understanding history is so important when you want to write things like this, even when you want to write things like fantasy. It's so important, I would say, for every kind of literature, especially given the situation in the world right now. Understanding history is crucial. It's key. And I mean, if you read Edgar Snow's Red Star Over China, you know, his book Red Star Over China, you know, I mean, read that if you want to know how dangerous trying to build a new society is in the face of imperialism and entrenched class hierarchies. You know, you had the Long March, you had the experience of like the Chinese Red Army. You know, where only a fraction of them on the Long March survived to reach northern China after their flight from the Yunnan Soviet. I mean, read about the beginnings of the Cuban Revolution and how few of the rebel fighters who traveled with Fidel Castro on the Granma, you know, and took that voyage from Mexico to Cuba in the mid-50s, you know, how few of them actually lived to see the revolution succeed in 1959. You know, and then there's Spartacus's slave rebellion against ancient Rome. You know, like there's all these historical examples. I mean, there's nothing easy about making real change in an oppressive society that has become unlivable for so many of its people and become incredibly brutal against those who fight for change. People fight and sacrifice against immense odds in these situations because the situation has become intolerable and these struggles succeed only when they have the organization and vision to succeed. And that doesn't emerge overnight. Successful revolutions, you know, such as the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, only come about after a long series of failed attempts, failed organizations, failed ideas. you know, going back decades. They only come about after a history of struggle that then builds up, a history of struggle and experience of struggle that then builds up to a point where the continuity of history is broken and something new and radical can emerge. You know, because it builds up to that revolutionary point. You know, a point that pushes society over the edge and into something new, into a new environment where something new can be built. That's the truth of the matter. You know, it's a process. It's a struggle. It's a struggle of organization and experience. You know, hard experience. And I've never seen that explored in a single fantasy genre story, not even once. I mean, science fiction comes closer. But even there, I haven't seen a story that would do justice to how revolutions actually happen. And how people actually liberate themselves. For revolution to be possible, the normal cycle of oppression in society has to be broken. I mean, medieval peasants rose up in rebellion more than we were ever taught in school. But their struggles rarely developed coherent alternatives to the existing state of things in a society where feudal lords lived on the backs of multitudes of serfs. And they weren't really able to conceive of new societies and building something new and have the ideas and the organization and the experience necessary to build new societies. They didn't have that. Even though they did fight back, of course, right? And fight back very, very intensely against the powers that be that were oppressing them. I mean, fatalistic attitudes were very common in a medieval society where peasants would often never see their 30th birthday and such attitudes were promoted, in fact, by elites in the church and state who wanted the peasants to know their place and to accept their misery as being part of some divine plan. And certainly attitudes like that and overcoming attitudes like that play a role in the story I plan to write, in the trilogy I plan to write. Well, I've started writing, but I'm on the second draft of my first novel. I mean, listen to this song by the doom metal band Chemist called A Conversation with Death. It's a metal version of an old Appalachian dirge, which shares a lot of features, themes, and imagery with medieval English songs. And the people of Appalachia, along with the people of Quebec and Acadia, are about the only white people in North America, I would say, with real traditions of resistance as marginalized and oppressed nations in North America. So the hillbillies, if you want to call them that, the hillbillies of Appalachia still sing English peasant songs from the 1300s. And that's part of their identity as a people. I mean, just listen to the lyrics here. I'm just going to play it. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Hold it. Hold it. Won't you spare me over till another year. We'll
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was the metal band Chemist with their song Conversation with Death, which is based on an Appalachian folk song. And to really understand where that song comes from, you have to understand a little bit, of course, about Appalachia, the mountainous region of what is now the eastern United States that produced those lyrics. And that region has a unique history. Not only did early poor white settlers flee there when the lowlands of the southern U.S. were taken over by cotton plantations, but escaped black slaves also fled there and founded whole maroon communities in the backcountry. And there was also a lot of intermarriage with the local indigenous peoples like the Cherokee. And deserters from the Confederate Army even fled there during the American Civil War because they didn't want to fight for the slaveocracy anymore in the American South. And the resulting, all this intermixing and the resulting marginalized rural peasant communities in the mountains of Appalachia, these communities fought back when the land speculators, railroad barons, and coal mining companies came in the 19th century. And that resistance continues to the present in places like West Virginia, where environmental devastation is almost apocalyptic, and where in some cases people literally are almost fighting for survival and the survival of their communities against like coal mining companies who have like the politicians in their back pockets and the cops in their back pockets and you name it. And of course, the, long, long history of, like, class struggle in West Virginia and, like, in other parts of Appalachia. Where these communities, of course, are organizing and fighting back. And they have this entire history of struggle and being marginalized, of existing in a marginalized situation. And all this produced quite a unique culture that has often been denigrated as, inbred and slandered in many of the same ways that white America has historically denigrated indigenous people, denigrated them as backward savages and even as cannibals. I mean, there are multiple horror stories and even Hollywood movies, like whole Hollywood movies portraying hillbillies as cannibals. And that goes back to the days when Appalachians, the inhabitants of this mountainous region in the eastern U.S. were attacked as having, gone Indian because of their way of life, which didn't fit into the way people of European descent were supposed, quote, supposed to behave. So when poor Appalachians, for, economic reasons, they basically were economic refugees, like within their own country, when poor Appalachians came to Chicago in the 1960s seeking jobs, and moved into basically what became almost, ghettoized communities effectively, even though, they're white people, but I mean, they're still living in effectively ghettoized communities. Like, the whole neighborhood of Chicago was called Hillbilly Harlem. That was its nickname back in those days, And they were dealing with all kinds of harassment from the cops, from the authorities, this sort of thing, all kinds of denigration. And it's really no surprise that they were the mainstay of white support for the Black Panthers in Chicago. And for Fred Hampton, Black Panther Party leader Fred Hampton's Rainbow Coalition. And these Appalachians even formed radical groups like the Young Patriots that stood in solidarity. These white people standing in solidarity with the African-American freedom struggle and making common cause with them against the capitalist state in America, which, of course, is oppressing them both. And that's something that's extremely rare in American history. I mean, understanding, like, the real history of, like, of race in America, as explained in The Invention of the White Race, that book by Theodore W. Allen, which I mentioned before. One of the reasons why whiteness was created and enshrined in law to begin with was to divide people of European and African descent and prevent them from working together against and fighting together against the colonial elite, right? So they, create this system which privileges certain people over others, certain group of people over others, and reduces the other people, to, of course, to outright slavery and servitude and misery and bondage. Meanwhile, the other people are at least, you know, they might exist in misery, but they're treated as human beings under the law. And that was used to divide and conquer people who had formerly joined together to make common cause against the colonial elite and fight for liberation for themselves. It was a divide and conquer tactic by the elite. And certainly, white working class people historically in North America have had a very, very hard time getting past the lure of whiteness and actually working together with black and brown people and with indigenous people and forming alliances, because whiteness forms this barrier which prevents them from doing so. But here you have in Chicago in the 1960s, you know, these people from Appalachia, these white Appalachians breaking through that barrier and uniting with black people, with the Black Panthers, and with the Young Lords, you know, a Latino organization which is also fighting the same struggle against the capitalist state. They united together in this Rainbow Coalition. It's a remarkable moment. And of course, that coalition was crushed, forcibly crushed by the authorities. You know, and Fred Hampton was assassinated, and Mark Clark was assassinated, and all that. But really, that gets to the point of what I really want to make here. You know, these historically marginalized and oppressed people, you know, from these different backgrounds, with a real experience of resisting established authority in the name of survival, even if they also have fatalistic attitudes towards the world around them, they can embrace revolutionary ideas and come together, even with people who look different from themselves, you know, but who are facing the same enemy. You know, they can embrace revolutionary ideas, they can see potential for real change, and that's a very powerful thing. And they can come together and build something new, strive to build a new society, and enact revolutionary change. You know, they come to understand where they are now, they see where they want to go, and they develop the tools and the organizational means to get there together. You know, real heroes are made when people wake up like this. But they're never alone. Real heroes are never alone. They're always part of something greater than themselves. Always part of a real movement of people that carries them along and propels them to do the things that they do. You know, that's why Fred Hampton of the Black Panthers was such a hero in Chicago, you know, uniting all these people, you know, black, white, Latino, bringing them all together. And showing such courage again, even like in the face of the capitalist state, which ultimately killed him. You know, right to the end, he moved with the people. He worked with the people. And that's also why Fidel Castro was such a hero and what he did in Cuba. You know, taking this impoverished, colonized society and building a new nation, effectively. You know, the socialist, was independent, was, you know, strove for justice for everyone, every man, woman, and child. You know, defeated racism. You know, sexism, fights against homophobia. You know, built a revolutionary healthcare system that takes care of everyone. You know, sends doctors all around the world to help out when, say, like, you know, hurricanes hit, you know, recently in the Bahamas and all this kind of stuff. It's Cuban doctors who go in there first, save people's lives. You know, it's also why Thomas Sankara, who led a revolution in West Africa in 1983 that took the former French colony of Upper Volta and renamed it Burkina Faso, which literally means the land of upright men. You know, it's also why he was such a hero. Struggling to transform his country and, you know, and secure justice for his people and like a livable future for his people. And of course, he was also assassinated for that. Just like Fred Hampton was assassinated in Chicago, like Thomas Sankara was assassinated in a coup that was backed by France, you know, the former colonial power, you know, which didn't want Burkina Faso to like be a bastion of independence in West Africa. You know, people like, you know, people like Fred Hampton, Fidel Castro, Thomas Sankara. This is the kind of hero that I want to see in the novels that I read. You know, including fantasy and sci-fi novels. You know, and I'm just not seeing it. I'm just not seeing those kind of heroes, and that has to change. You know, I want heroes that serve the people. And I think, you know, this is, you know, my opinion. You know, I think, just like philosophers, the job of writers of fiction in this day and age is to interpret the world as a means of transforming it. You know, the point is to transform it, as Marx said. You know, not just to like give you a picture of the world, not just to give you a snapshot, this kind of thing, but to strive to transform the world, to build something better, to move towards a livable future in this age of crisis and, you know, environmental catastrophe and all that, and like, you know, capitalism gone berserk. Writers have their role to play. Fantasy genre writers are not removed from this. They're not removed from the world. Even if they often indulge in like escapism, you know, they're not removed from the world. No human being is. They too need to play a progressive role in history. And they too need to stand upright. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
L'imperialisme! L'imperialisme! Le néocolonialisme! Le racisme! Le fascisme! Gloire!
Honneur!
Dignité!
Honneur!
Pouvoir!
Honneur!
La patrie ou la mort! La patrie ou la mort!
Now you may know him as Africa's Che Guevara, Burkina Faso's captain to Thomas Sankara. Born in 1849 in what was Upper Volta, part of French colonial West Africa. Raised in the midst of newfound independence, shaped in 1960 from the colonists. But that was just politically, merely on the surface. Economically, the status is really worthless. Is a country really free just because it has a coat of arms, a national anthem, and a flag? But many African leaders did show the way, like Kwame Nkrumah or Sekou Touré. In that spirit, Sankara came up, a desire to see his people raised up, to be free from the bondage of IMF, and to take meaningful and tangible steps. Standing upright, looking towards the future. Standing upright, saying what we've been used to. Standing upright, living incorruptible. Standing upright, struggle is uncomfortable. Standing upright, homeland to death now. Standing upright, people take the reins now. Standing upright, even when they try to kill. Standing upright, you know they won't be standing here. The 4th of August of 1983, a coup d'etat brings Sankara to the presidency. But it wasn't just replacing a figurehead, it was deeply transformative, beginning with a full-scale attack upon patriarchy to lift women up to status of equality. He took the land back, no longer in a few hands, along with mineral wealth away from the man. He knew that foreign aid was only that a name. Instead of helping, it was there to shackle and chain. The Burkinabe revolution wasn't top down. Sankara led it, but the people had the power now. Were the neighborhood committees, which were the source of a local kind of governance. A real democracy was born, freedom in the air, with the French ruling class in utter despair. Standing upright, looking towards the future. Standing upright, saying what we've been used to. Standing upright, living incorruptible. Standing upright, struggle is uncomfortable. Standing upright, homeland to death now. Standing upright, people take the reins now. Standing upright, even when they try to kill. Standing upright, you know the world stands here. That name was played out and didn't really represent the direction in which the country was heading. But Burkina Faso was much more telling. The land of upright, land of incorruptibles. Sankara himself exemplified the principle, never using his position as president to attain even slightest privileges. In fact, he had very few personal possessions, a motorbike, an average car, and a guitar. But he shunned using even air conditioning, because the Burkinabe people weren't living in a similar state, having an abundance. But there were forces corrupting and lusting to turn back the clock, sell off the land again, and that's what they did in October 87. Standing upright, looking towards the future. Standing upright, saying what we've been used to. Standing upright, living incorruptible. Standing upright, struggle is uncomfortable.
Okay. Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Marcel Cartier with Standing Upright, song about Thomas Sankara. Of course, I was just talking about before the revolutionary of Burkina Faso in West Africa, who liberated that country. And is still a legend in Africa today. I mean, like, you know, like I've had conversations with, you know, Nigerian students in China, and they know who he is, and they know exactly, you know, what he stands for, you know, and the kind of hero that he is, and how he served the people. And like I said before, like, that's the kind of hero that I want to see in, you know, in the kind of genre, you know, where I write, when I write fantasy stories, fantasy novels, those are the kind of heroes I want to have. You know, heroes that serve the people. And this is the kind of hero I think that we need in literature today. And these heroes definitely are not perfect. There's nothing perfect about them. But they're struggling for something. They stand for something. They want to mobilize the people for something. For a livable future. For a just future. And this is really what I strive for when I write. And I think this is a very, very important thing to do. You know, this is really what I try to do. So, like, you know, this is, we're getting to the end of Back in the USSR, this episode of Back in the USSR. And, yeah. Like I said before, the writers are not removed, regardless of what genre they write in. They're not removed from the world. They're coming out of the material world, the material conditions of the world that they're coming up in. And they have to see the realities of the world that we live in. And they need to play. It's a responsibility that they have to play a progressive role in history. They have to stand upright, transform the world. Because right now, things cannot stay the way they are. There has to be a change. There has to be transformation. That must happen. So I'm going to sign off right now. So please join me here, same time next week for Back in the USSR. Until then, take care, brothers and sisters. All the best.
Yeah. 1, 2, 1, 2. Flow, calm back, be out.